Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.
So this talk has the title of A Religious Response to Climate Change. It's religious because we are responding from our spiritual practice, from meditation, and from the precepts, not from our opinions, our views, our emotions, and our agenda. The effects of climate change are beyond political or geographic alliance or borders or race or ethnicity. It includes all of us and animals and trees and all life on the planet. So today we're not talking about solving the problem or fixing it or coming up with solutions or ecological practices, but we are talking about training with. And with is the important word. We're talking about looking at climate change, being able to think about it, being able to talk about it. And I would just like to offer today a few of the things that sustain me, a few of the spiritual practices and attitudes of mind that I have found helpful. The first, of course, is the teaching of our tradition. At a monastic conference on the environment some years ago, one of the monks said, "Don't think in terms of saving the planet," he said. "Think in terms of cherishing all life." So we should all be able to feel at home with that. That is the bedrock of the Buddhist teaching that he handed down to us. And this is one of my favorite stories from Bhikkhu Nanamoli's Life of the Buddha. This is an early example to illustrate that. This took place when the Buddha was living in the bamboo grove, and he had not yet made residence in one place obligatory for the monks. So this is what it says. The bhikkhus went wandering, that is, they would go off and offer the teaching. They were wandering in the cold season, in the hot season, and in the rainy season. People were annoyed, and they murmured and protested. "How can these monks, these sons of the Shakyans, go wandering in all three seasons, trampling down the green grass, harassing one-facultied life," apparently that's just the tiny creatures, "and bringing harm to many little creatures? Even these other sectarians with their ill-proclaimed ideal do at least keep to their residence during the rains. And even these vultures that make their nests on the treetops do at least keep to their residence during the rains. But these Shakyan clan monks go wandering in all three seasons, trampling down the green grass, harassing one-facultied life, and bringing harm to many little creatures." So the bhikkhus heard this, and they told the Blessed One. He made this the occasion for a talk on the law, and he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, I allow a fixed residence for the rains." The monks stayed in one place during the rainy season so as not to disturb all the living creatures. Now, when I was living in the Bay Area and went to Reverend Master Jiu's talks at UC Berkeley, she talked about not killing insects, and we all spent hours, if any of you were there and remember this, we spent hours talking about how to remove insects safely without killing them. And I had a really profound experience of the power of the precepts very early on this very matter. When I got back to my apartment after having gone to the Abbey to formally take the precepts at Jukai, I had left the windows open in my apartment, so when I got back, it was full of these mosquito hawks, my least favorite creature. And up until that time, I would just take a newspaper and swat them. But I remember very vividly picking up a newspaper, rolling it up, going over to one of these mosquito hawks, and all of a sudden I got an extremely clear message, internal message, I can't do this anymore. And so, thinking back on these many talks about safely removing insects, I went and got a broom, and I held it under one of these little guys. He climbed off onto the broom, and I took them out one by one. And for me, that was a wonderful experience of not even having to think, this is the precept on do not kill, so I can't kill these creatures. It just was something that I could see, I can't do this anymore. And since then, I have heard so many wonderful stories from people about what you all have learned from insects. As it turns out, we love sharing these stories. Maybe we'll do that this afternoon. But really, it is amazing the teaching that we have gotten from these tiny creatures. And I would like to share another story, which I think some of you have met, heard before, but I think it is, I think it's a good one to tell now because it illustrates the power of someone doing their own training, having no idea what effect they might have on somebody else. We had a young woman in her early 20s, come to an introductory retreat at the urging of her mother, who had been here several times before and found these retreats really helpful, wanted her daughter to come because she was very concerned about her daughter. Her daughter had 5 kids, and she was in a deep depression. And so she thought a weekend at the Abbey would be helpful. So her daughter came, and she participated in the weekend. And at the end of the weekend, I asked her, so how did it go? And she said, I saw the tallest monk in the monastery bend down to take a caterpillar out of the cloister so it wouldn't be stepped on, she said. Sorry. And it gave me hope. This is the power of our practice. This is how we share our intimate connection with one another and with all life. This is the teaching of the Buddha. This is what has been passed down to us. This is our heritage. And this is what we can offer now in these difficult times, knowing the power of it. So the Buddhist teaching is as relevant today as it was 2,600 years ago. You know, it really helps us to understand what it is we have contributed to our current situation in the environment. And the more honestly and forthrightly we can look at that, the more we can see what it is we can do to shift the course of events at this point. So doing what a lot of us already do, making use of the ordinary acts of our daily life to express the Buddha's teaching, is a fundamental part of the Zen tradition. At the Abbey, as you know if you have been here, our ecological practices are a means of keeping the Buddha's teaching alive. And and certainly honoring Dogen's teaching, who gave us in minute detail how to see the Buddha nature in everything around us, in a stalk of cabbage, in a pot in the kitchen. Reverend Master Jiyu saw the recycling movement in this country back in the 70s. I remember this well. She said, "This is the most encouraging spiritual movement that I have seen in this country." She said, "Because it has taught us that we can't get rid of anything. We can't throw things out. We can only see the potential value in them and convert them into things that are useful." So she saw this as a sign of spiritual renewal in the United States, because it taught us how to not waste anything and how to see the potential in all things. And on a spiritual level, she taught us that in like manner, the passions of greed, hatred, and delusion could be converted, and we could recycle them into compassion, love, and wisdom. So this points to the attitudes of mind that we need to cultivate now to enable us to find common ground amidst diverse groups and points of view in order to realize our shared goal, which is to preserve the life of all of us and this planet and the life that it supports. So I think really one of the most important things that we do right now is to actually be willing to look at climate change. The enormity of the problem has made it difficult to comprehend, and the gravity of it, with an ever-decreasing window of opportunity to shift the course of events, makes it extremely difficult for people to be willing to look at. The implication of the consequences of the rapid rate of climate change to all life on this planet are so overwhelming that our major response has been simply to deny it, to look away, to turn away. But I'm remembering that 10 years ago, if you tried to talk about global warming, many people's eyes would just kind of glaze over and they would depart as quickly as possible. But now it's become a priority and it's in the news all the time, which I think is a very positive it's a many splendored thing, isn't it? But one of the basic Buddhist teachings is to see clearly, to not look away. So in order to be able to look at climate change, to be able to think about it, and to be willing to talk about it, I want to just talk about a few things that I have found helpful and I think help in part at least about the most frequent thing that I hear from people who are wanting to face the challenge of climate change but simply say they are overwhelmed. So I think the first thing that we can do, of course, is to ground ourselves in our practice and make meditation our default position. Sit through the grief, the fear, the sorrow, the anxiety. Not push it away. Let it be there. How could it be otherwise, really? But within the meditation, we can connect with the source that sustains and nourishes us, no matter what the conditions are. So, sitting still. And what are the ways that we can do that? Because many people are saying now they find it particularly difficult to sit still on their own at home. And especially during this period of time when people are sheltering. So, of course, it helps a lot if you can do formal meditation for 20 minutes for half an hour, for 5 minutes, for 30 seconds. I can remember being at a talk with Reverend Master Jiu in Berkeley when a woman with 5 kids said to her, "How can I possibly have time to meditate? I've got 5 kids. She said, "Well, can you sit on the edge of your bed for 30 seconds when you get up in the morning?" From Reverend Master Jiu's point of view, there was nothing that could not be done, and no effort was wasted. So 30 seconds, if that's hard, walking meditation. If that's not your cup of tea, then working meditation. The work that you do in your house, you can make a meditation, or the work you do wherever you are, simply keep coming back to what you are doing. So on this matter of sitting alone, we can remember that whenever we are sitting, actually we're never sitting alone, because people all over the world on the other side of the globe are always sitting. There's somebody always sitting with us, whether they're in the room with us or not. There are some folks who have discovered sitting over the phone. This is a wonderful practice. You call a friend or a family member, you know, give your greetings, put the phone down, and you both sit together and then have a chat at the end of it. People have found this very helpful. So these are all ways of quieting ourselves down and returning to the source. We also, of course, have the Gassho. Gassho is always available to us, and in just a moment takes us to our sitting place, the place beyond the opposites. And I always remind people, you have to put your hands tight together. Leave no space between the fingers for fear and worry. And boy, when you really put your hands together, you can feel it, right? You can feel the power of that mudra, of that position. And you just can cut through all kinds of difficult states of mind. This is one of the gifts that Reverend Master Jiu taught us. Also, of course, the rosary, very helpful if you have one. You can count your breaths on it. You can say the three homages. You can circulate your breath. You can offer merit. You can find intuitive ways to make use of it. Some people, including myself, just like to sometimes have it in my pocket so that when I put my hand in my pocket, I've got something to grab onto if I need it. So it's a wonderful tool. If you haven't tried it yet and you have one, you can experiment. This is a wonderful time to use it to try to just get centered. So I want to share with you some wonderful teaching that Reverend Master Koten passed down. I think it was several years ago, but I think it is particularly helpful right now. As I say, for people who are finding it difficult to meditate in the usual ways that you're used to. So he says, how to meditate without sitting down. He says, I've been asked to write something about meditation for those who are unable to sit physically in any comfortable way or who have to spend a lot of time in bed. And I'm just going to add to that, to any of the rest of us that find this practice helpful. He says, in considering this request, I found myself, much to my surprise, wanting to talk first of all about the precepts, that is, starting with do no harm. While you are lying there or trying to go about your day, make a determination. Begin the morning with a commitment to try to do no harm. Speak no harm, think no harm, wish no harm. When you are distracted, worried, in pain, discouraged, come back to do no harm. Remind yourself that whatever else you are unable to do, you can do that, and that itself is something very useful. Next, try to let go of worry over the news. I have edited that a little bit because the news is worrisome, and he says leave it behind when it gets overwhelming. He says, try practicing this for several days. There should be more calm. Explore this calm. When you experience a calm moment throughout the day, stop whatever you are doing and rest in it. It is a refuge. You can trust it. It is a door. So that's a wonderful practice in itself, a very powerful practice. Just come back to do no harm. Just keep coming back to that. So the implication here is that this is a wonderful time to deepen your practice and trust what brought you to it. Whether you can articulate that or not, do not delude yourself that you don't know. Trust what brought you here, trust what brought you to sit with us today. Most of what will help you during this period of time, you already know. But use the precepts as your guide, rather than your own opinions or preferences, and keep bringing them to mind to keep yourself in harmony with that which is greater than ourselves. Master Hua, who is the late abbot of the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and he was a renowned master and scholar of the scriptures and the sutras. One day a monk came to him in great despair, and he said, I study the scriptures and the sutras, and I don't understand anything that I'm reading. I must be a bad monk. And Master Hua said, don't worry about what you don't understand, he said. Worry about what you do understand and are not putting into practice. Well, sometimes we just have to laugh at ourselves when we get these very direct teachings, right? So, I want to talk for just a little bit about how we use the current events in the service of our practice. Our present consumer economy is certainly linked to climate change. It's based primarily on feelings of separation, feelings of isolation and craving, looking for something satisfying to fill us up. We got distracted, and we got encouraged to take refuge in things outside of ourselves. But as someone said, you can never get enough of what you really didn't want in the first place. So this constant buying has had a tremendous cost to the environment, and it is much too high for us to continue paying. Now here's an interesting description in Ajahn Amaro's article, Three Robes is Enough, in a book called Hooked. He's talking about events in Thailand, and he says, two of the most well-known and oft-recited teachings of the Theravadan Buddhist scriptures extol the virtue of contentment and moderation, that is, knowing the right amount. In the late 1950s and 60s, as Thailand launched itself into the international marketplace, the Thai government made the extraordinary move of specifically asking the leading abbots and teachers of the Thai Buddhist community to not encourage these qualities in their population. In their drive to encourage productivity and consumerism, the political powers regarded moderation and contentment as obstacles to their program. Well, we'd have to agree with that, wouldn't we? Sad to say, most of the monastic community acquiesced to this request, being culturally conditioned to not cause conflict and to maintain the status quo. However, one prominent teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, had no fear of those in power. Although he had official ranks and titles, he was not at all worried about losing them if he spoke up. So he came right out and he openly challenged the politicians, asking them if they felt they were wiser than the Buddha. Surely the Buddha would never have extolled qualities so highly and universally regarded if he thought there was something possibly harmful, he asked. Ajahn Buddhadasa showed how greed, selfishness, and wastefulness were actually the more harmful qualities, and that a healthy economy would need to be based on wholesome rather than unwholesome principles. Buddhadasa drew on the early Buddhist scriptures, warning that if the government pursued its chosen policies, it was likely to do more harm than good in the long run. Needless to say, he was heavily criticized for getting involved in politics and rocking the boat, but it was hard for anybody to fault him on his scholarship, his reasoning, or his straightforwardness. His voice was heard, and eventually the government ban on contentment was lifted. You know, isn't that wonderful, the power of one voice? I think during this pandemic, the very fact that our federal and state governments have not adequately addressed the many problems that we have had has inspired action on a local and unprecedented grassroots level. You know, it's as though this lockdown itself has become a vehicle for empowering people and freeing them from previously stuck energy, you know, to find innumerable ways of helping people. So during this pandemic, we've seen people coming together to find solutions, competitors working together, people working across political grounds, across political borders. I think we are laying the groundwork to continue to form relationships for common ground, for common need, rather than personal profit. Now, I want to just say something about what seems to me to be a recurrent theme of concern about the lack of agreement on many issues that are facing at this time. And I would like to just remind us of a Buddhist teaching, which is the all is one and the all is different. We tend to look with one eye and see, you know, if you just look with one eye on the all is one, you can get kind of romantic and dewy-eyed about that. I can remember there was a bit of that in the 60s in the Bay Area, the all is one. And then if you look with the other eye and see the all is different, you can kind of go into despair because it seems like there isn't any ground for agreement, people coming together. But in fact, they're both true at the same time. And rather than this being a cause for concern, it's possible that it is a reflection of the various experiences, points of view, cultural, geographical, etc., backgrounds that people are bringing to the table. And Buddhism has always embraced diversity. There are 250 schools of Buddhism, probably more, and they all have different practices. And nobody's worried about that. Everyone, it's wonderful. We always say how wonderful it is that there are so many different ways of practicing Buddhism because everybody can find one that fits for them. You know, the Buddhist scriptures are full of descriptions of the bodhisattvas who go to great lengths to find, to appear in any form that is going to help someone. So there is this wonderful, it's really quite wonderful, embracing of diversity in Buddhism. As a matter of fact, the last precept, do not defame the three treasures, says, to do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world. And the merit of doing such a thing becomes the source of all wisdom. Do not criticize, but accept everything. The lord of the house does not do things in the normally accepted ways, nor do the Buddhists and patriarchs. Okay, that includes us. They are not individual, and they are not the same as each other. Each expresses the truth in his own way, as do all things. They do that which is their way and express the Lord within it. That's us. That's all of us. Do not criticize the way of another. Do not call it into question. Look within it and see the Lord. So I would say, rather than being, well, let me put it differently. Well, let's just find another way to think about the events that are going on in these times. Let's think of ways that are inclusive instead of setting up the opposites and getting into the all or nothing. Give you an example of that. A young woman at an introductory retreat said she was on her way, she was on leave from a job she had in Europe, working for a World Hunger Relief Agency. This agency was based in Europe, and she thought she was going to have to quit. She said the agency had banners hung in the office that said, "Goal, zero world hunger." She said the unreality of it was so oppressive, the unreality of that sort of goal was something she just didn't feel she could live with anymore. Now, Reverend Master Jihu taught us an entirely different approach. As I remember, at a talk in Berkeley that she was giving, a young man approached her afterwards and asked for some help in stopping smoking. And what he said was, I really want to try stopping, I want to quit smoking. He said, I've tried everything and nothing has worked. He said, can you help me? And she looked at him and she said, well, can you go for 5 minutes without a cigarette? And then she said, well, if you can, do it again. You know, this is the start where you are, Reverend Margaret was talking about yesterday. I remember her telling someone who was profoundly depressed, asking a question. He asked a question at one of the classes. He said, I'm so depressed I can't get out of bed in the morning. Have you got some advice for me? And she said, well, take your bedroom slippers, she said, and put them carefully under your bed. Line them up and put them carefully, she said, under your bed. That is your first act of the day. That sets the day, the tone of the day. That is your intention to align yourself with something that is greater. I would like to share with you, I think, an example of what I was referring to in terms of thinking carefully about how we phrase things and how we put things. Actually, with these various ways that we talk about things and see things, this is how we create our world. These are the building blocks of our world. So when we have a sense of the power of that, then we can begin really to use those building blocks in a beneficial way. So here is something that Robert Aiken, the late Roshi Robert Aiken, wrote in his book Mind of Clover. On the precept of not killing. He says, speaking truth to power is the ideal of the society of friends, nonviolent and inclusive. Recently, leaders of a peace organization arranged to meet with a senior military officer with broad authority. He says, I don't know why he agreed to meet with them, and I didn't hear the outcome of the meeting. But I was told about the discussions in the organization before the meeting took place, and the delegation had to decide what to say. After role-playing several scenarios, the members just gave up and decided just to open the conversation with this question, how is it going? In other words, with your truly awesome power, with nuclear war, a possible outcome of something you might decide to do in an emergency, how are you bearing up? When we speak from the same side of the counter in this way, then we are human beings together. The we-they dichotomy falls away, and peace has a chance. And I would add, so does everything else. so does the environment, so does racism, so does violence, so does economic equality. How to learn to speak in this way. Actually, the precepts can help that, help us with that, can't they? And you know, when we get ourselves stuck, we can kind of ask ourselves, well, what's in the way here? What are we putting in the way? So I got my papers out of order here, and I need to shuffle for a few minutes. Gee, it's to see what to finish up with. You know, I think it's pretty clear that we're going to be asked to change our lifestyle. What that's going to mean, we don't know, but we can practice. We've been practicing. I often think that things that we think of as being inconvenient are things that our grandparents would have thought were just simply the things of daily life, you know. So I'm looking forward to our being able to talk about some of these things this afternoon, but I want to end with a story. Was a story I got out of an animal magazine, and it was written by Mark Beckoff. Some of you may have seen others of his writing. I can find it. Maybe I didn't bring it with me. Hang on. Here it is, all right. It's called The Dog in the Lifeboat. So he was talking to, Mark Beckoff was talking to some students in a program for kids. And the basic tenets of the program are that every individual is important, and every individual makes a difference. So here is the situation. This is a third grade class. This was part of this Roots and Shoots program, which has this particular focus. He says, I pose the following question as an often used thought experiment to a group of young students. There are three humans and one dog in a lifeboat that can only hold three bodies. Which of the four should be thrown overboard? Generally, when this situation is discussed, most people agree that all things being equal, reluctantly, the dog has to go. But the students didn't give up easily. The level of discussion overwhelmed me. Students raised consideration of quality of life, longevity, value of life, and losses to surviving family and friends. But what really amazed and pleased me was that after we discussed alternatives, the students wanted to work it out so nobody had to be thrown overboard. I experienced this line of reasoning in numerous different countries in similarly aged kids. This is third grade. Going overboard or not is the question. So they ask, well, why does anybody have to go overboard? Let's not do it. When I said the thought experiment required that at least one individual had to be tossed, they said it simply wasn't acceptable. Then they started to generate ideas about how all the individuals could be saved, such as, having the dog swim alongside of the boat and feeding her, having them all take turns swimming, throwing shoes and all the other things that weren't needed overboard in order to reduce the weight and bulk, cutting the boat in two, making two rafts. All the students decided that even if the dog had to go, she'd have a better chance of living because more could be done by the humans to save the dog than vice versa. Very sophisticated reasoning indeed. I've discussed this example many times with numerous different groups of older students and adults, and never before had a group unanimously decided that everybody must be saved. I sat there smiling and thinking, now these are the kind of people in whose hands I would feel comfortable placing my future. See, they were in the third grade some years back. They're teenagers now. There's a whole generation of young people out there that we can trust. Put our future in their hands. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha.